It's Wednesday, February 22nd, 1989. This is Hearing Room C, the Senate Labor Committee.
So 731 and 112 will be the focus, 731 being the major focus. Go for it. Okay, we will call the Senate Labor Committee to order. We're going to go by our agenda, which calls on us first to have a short and I think straightforward work session on Senate Bills 114 and 115. First, I want to correct the record. The chair made the motion to send Senate Bill 365 to the floor with a due pass recommendation when we last met. That's the Wage Security Fund, I should have said, to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there an objection to correction of the record?
No problem.
Here, no problem. So ordered, we will. That's where it is anyway. We thought we'd have the record show it being in the proper place. We'll open the work session on 114 and 115. One of these has got some amendments and one does not. Is that correct or both?
Yes.
No, just one. 115. Okay. 115 has amendment. 114. And it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means so that they can go down there and fight over whether the Bureau gets to keep, what is it, $80,000? In fees charged for the under the labor Farm Labor Contracting Act. Is there a motion on the measure, Senator Hill? Is there a motion on sending 114 to the Ways and Means Committee?
I will so move if it.
Thank you.
You'd like
Senator Shoemaker moves Senate Bill 114 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation to that committee. Is there a discussion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, then it is ordered unanimously by the members present. 115. Does have an amendment brought to us by the commissioner, and the chair would move the commissioner's amendments, which are identified as SB 115-1, Senate Labor 22189. Annette, you want to give us the skinny on why it is we're doing that?
Yes.
Other than the fact that the commissioner asked us to.
Commissioner Roberts and Marilyn Koffel may address this if she feels that the need to, had said that they had decided not to alter the term where the current licenses go from February 1st to January 31st. They wanted to keep that term instead of the proposed change, which was in Section 2. So we've deleted Section 2. I think it was for purposes of having, being clear that all licenses expire at a certain time so there wouldn't be a bookkeeping problem of knowing who had a valid license. And then Section 3 basically enacts Section 2, so that was also deleted.
That was the rulemaking authority for Section 2. Okay, so the sum of it is that the you leave the, what is it, January 31 or whatever the day is, or is a
February 1 to January 31
calendar year for the license. Mm-hmm. You move from 15 to 60 days on a temporary permit.
Right.
And we took out this business.
Senator
up and down
Shoemaker,
stuff.
Right, said that he thought if it was going to be 60 days, right, you wanted them not to be able to renew for the 15
right.
days.
Right, right. And that makes sense. Okay.
5 days.
Or 5 days.
All right, Chair moves the amendments. Is there objection to the adoption of the amendment? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Motion on the bill to the floor. Hello?
I'll move it.
Oh.
I'm easy.
All right. Senator Shoemaker, move Senate Bill 115 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Objection to the motion? If not, then it's been reported as unanimous by the members present. Okay. Let us open our public hearing on four bills, Senate Bill 112, 731, 732, and 733. They are not all the same, but they're all under the same general heading. And we would expect that when people come up, they are certainly free to visit among the bills as they feel they want to and don't need to simply speak on them serially. That gets confusing and it's a waste of your time. So when you've got something to say on one of the bills that hasn't been said before and you want to tell us about it, please feel free to let us know. Senator
Schumer?
Have we encountered these before?
No, we have encountered Senate Bill 112, we had a hearing on with 114 and 115. It's carried over today because many of the elements in 112 are also contained in 731, which is a larger bill than that. Okay. So what I'm going to do is do two things. We're going to call on Senator Hill to describe the bills, and then we're going to call former Governor Straub forward, or whether you're going to appear together.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hamby is here, and if she would like to, she can join me at the witness stand or whatever.
Sure, come on down.
Okay, this is this whole thing. Oh, yeah, we went over this at great length.
Yes. Recognize all of these.
Always hope. That's
one well one.
Say what?
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Senator Larry Hill representing District 21. I'm the chief sponsor, along with Senator Hamby, of Senate Bills 731, 732, and 733. And to inform the committee about what each of those bills does and is intended to do, I'll go through each one and then speak briefly to the need and to the experience of the interim committee in regard to the migrant problems in the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 731 relates to farm labor contractors. It provides that farm labor contractor provisions regarding requirements for health, safety, and habitability of any housing, travel conditions, payment of claims, and licensing, and the defined seasonal farm worker and seasonal farm worker housing. In looking at the farm worker issues last summer and fall, it became obvious that there is not a real consistent definition of seasonal farm worker housing, farm labor camp. One of the things we're attempting to do in this set of bills, and some other bills that are going to business, housing, and finance, and revenue committees, is to adopt standardized definitions. So we have a definition of seasonal farm worker that means a person who's working in performing temporary labor for another in the production of farm products or forestry products. And you can read the rest of the definition there. Bill provides some of the things that are contained in 112. There's very similar provisions in this bill to the other licensing bill of farm labor contractors that we have before us today. It allows that majority shareholders of a corporation may be licensed as farm labor contractors. It provides that, a cooperative corporation may be licensed as a farm labor contractor. That's all in Section 3. In Section 4, we have a provision that no license may be issued to a farm labor contractor unless the applicant has passed an examination designed to test the applicant's knowledge of the obligations and prohibitions of the law. And we have some provisions that direct the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to have a certain number of examinations per year. and some other provisions regarding English and Spanish offerings of that exam. In Section 5, we amend existing law to provide that each person acting as a farm labor contractor shall, if the farm labor contractor employs workers, the contractor shall substantially comply with the provisions relating to field sanitation and its implementation and regulations. That the field sanitation law is existing law, but we don't have clear responsibility of the contractor to comply with that law. Also, the farm labor contractor who owns and controls housing furnished to workers in connection with the recruitment or employment of workers as seasonal farm workers, the contractor shall assure that the housing substantially complies with any applicable law relating to health, safety, and habitability. We're giving the farm labor contractor that responsibility, which they is not clear in the law currently. Sub C, we're providing that if the farm labor contractor induces any worker to travel, and this is similar to the point we discussed yesterday, if the farm labor contractor induces any worker to travel from one point to another for the purpose of working as a seasonal farm worker at a time prior to the availability of such employment, the contractor shall furnish to any such worker at no charge lodging and an adequate supply of food until employment begins. If employment does not begin within a reasonable time, the contractor shall refund to any such worker all sums paid by the worker to the contractor and provide cost of transportation and food in the course of transportation back to the site from which the worker was induced to travel. Or the worker may choose to travel to another work site if the cost of travel to that work site is less expensive than the cost of travel back to the place they came from. And that gives some flexibility. The worker could move on to Washington State, for instance, rather than back to Texas. We also provide that no person acting as a farm labor contractor or applying for a license to act as a farm labor contractor shall solicit or induce or cause to be solicited or induced the travel of a worker from one place to another by representing to the worker that employment for the worker is available at the destination when employment for the worker is not available within a reasonable period of time. So that's further clarifying the contractor's responsibilities. We have in Section 6 language that requires that a person using a farm labor contractor, any person who knowingly uses an unlicensed farm labor contractor, assumes a liability, and that's similar to 112. Section 7, we provide penalties. Any person who violates the provisions of 410 and 417A is guilty of a Class C felony if the person has previously been convicted of violating the provisions of 410 or 417 sub 1. The person's license to act as a farm labor contractor has been suspended, revoked, or denied, or the person is acting in violation of an outstanding order of any court of competent jurisdiction. These are penalties placed upon the farm labor contractor who is a second or third offender. If they take a second or third bite of the apple, violate the law, abuse their employees, they have a criminal penalty to face. Section 9 provides that if a person acting as a farm labor contractor fails, neglects, or refuses to make prompt payment of a claim for labor or services furnished by a person in connection with a contractor agreement, et cetera, the Bureau of Labor and Industries may demand that the claim be paid. Let's see. The payment of a claim in the manner authorized in the section shall not relieve the contractor or the contractor's surety from obligation with respect to any unpaid claims. Excuse me. It's not that the Bureau can demand the claim be paid. The Bureau of Labor and Industries may... May pay and then charge it, go back and collect from the person who owed. Section 10, we provide the sections 4 and 8 to 11 of this act apply to all transactions, acts, and omissions of farm labor contractors and users of farm labor contractors that are within the bounds of the state to regulate and are not preempted by federal law. This is trying to address the question of enforceability against a contractor who transports against state lines, because we have interstate commerce entering into the picture, and we're trying to maximize our enforcement within the limits placed upon us by the interstate transportation provisions of the Constitution that preempt this. Section 11, we provide that the Bureau of Labor and Industries may adopt rules to carry out the provisions of this act. Section 12, we provide that, down towards the tail end of that, that in any action arising out of the activities of an unlicensed foreign labor contractor within the state is not in the state or is otherwise unavailable for service or process in the state, the unlicensed farm labor contractor may be served by mailing a certified true copy of the summons and complaint to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. So the Bureau can accept a summons if the farm labor contractor is outside the state and therefore allow the action to proceed. And Section 13, we provide that the Bureau of Labor and Industries may bring suit in any court of competent jurisdiction to enjoin any person from using the services of an unlicensed farm labor contractor. What we're accomplishing here is we're toughening the laws regulating farm labor contractors. We're trying to get at the abuse of the laws. We're trying to increase the risk of people who repeatedly abuse the laws. And we're trying to improve enforcement capability by the Bureau of Labor and Industries, which is currently the enforcing organization for farm labor contracting laws. And we're also adopting the standardized definition. Any questions on 731 that we can attempt to answer?
Senator Hamby, anything to...
I have no further comments on the bill, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senator Hill, of course, has been heavily involved in the drafting. And because I have for now, I guess, 3 decades been aware of the abuses, most especially focusing on the contractor law, I think I'm simply here to encourage you to closely look at it and certainly make the much needed changes that are long past due.
All right. Did you want to take a minute or two and over 32, 33?
32, I'll try to be briefer, Mr. Chairman and members. 732 relates to seasonal farm workers, and it regulates, rather than regulating the contractor, it attempts to create a regulatory scheme that's useful for the camps, the farm labor camps. It takes 2 separate tacks in attempting to do this. Currently, farm worker camps are registered under rule with Accident Prevention Division. There's not a statute that I know of that requires such registration. There are statutes that require compliance with the state Accident Prevention Division in enforcement of the state plan, which is our OSHA, our little OSHA, think of it in those terms. The state Accident Prevention Division has the responsibility under contract with the federal government to ensure that workplaces are safe in the state of Oregon, consistent with the state accident plan, and safety plan. That includes farm worker camps. They're considered to be a workplace, and therefore APD has jurisdiction to enforce the state plan. The state plan, however, doesn't extend to some things like contractor law enforcement. It applies to health and safety. So we've taken 2 different tacks. We've taken the tack of requiring in Senate Bill 732 that a camp operator obtain a license in order to operate a camp, that every camp must have 1 operator who's licensed to operate that camp, that a bond be posted by that operator to the amount of $15,000 to assure performance, and that persons who own or operate a camp have that camp registered, and we would require it in statute, with Accident Prevention Division. Now, the enforcement of the licensing requirement for the camp operator would be achieved through the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and it's very similar to their current enforcement of labor contractor licenses. If one is already a labor contractor and has a license, then one could simply get an endorsement to operate a camp. And if one is not a labor contractor, one would then obtain a license to operate a camp. The licenses would not be transferable between individuals or between camps. The intent is that an individual could obtain a license that would be good for more than 1 camp, but those camps would be identified. We'd need to correct a particular point of the bill to allow that. There is an error in the bill. It currently reads 1 license for 1 camp, and you can't operate more than 1 camp at a time. That needs to be corrected. But each camp would be operated by a named licensed operator who would bear the responsibility for not only meeting the state health and safety plan, but all other provisions of the state regarding the camp, such as access provisions, such as provisions beyond health and safety that relate to the camp. We'll be discussing those in 733 in just a minute. But APD would remain responsible for seeing that the camp meets the state health regulations, and they would maintain a registry of the camp. If a camp was unregistered, or if the camp was not operated by a licensed operator, then either agency could act to shut down the camp. That's our intent. It's to better use our current enforcement ability. And it's difficult because we do have the two agencies that, in a sense, share jurisdiction. And it's impossible, after looking at the issue for some months, I believe it's impossible to combine the jurisdictions. It can't be done under the current scheme because of our contract with the federal government. So we have to have the two agencies continue to enforce camp health and safety and access provisions and all other provisions that affect camps. But we have to improve the coordination and try to make that enforcement more effective. And that's the intent of 732. Briefly, Section 3 requires that a camp operator must have a license. Section 4 provides that the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry shall establish a licensing system. Section 5 provides that no license shall be granted unless the farm worker camp has been registered with APD. Section 6 provides that before a license is issued or renewed to a farm worker camp operator, there shall be a bond posted of $15,000. Section 7 requires the person operating the camp to keep accurate and current records, and that the commissioner's representative may inspect those records regarding operation of the camp. Section 8 provides the particular provisions that a farm worker camp operator must meet in operating the camp. For instance, conform to administrative rules, conform to building code, pay or distribute promptly all money or other things of value to the farm workers that they're owed, comply with terms and provisions of all legal and valid agreements or contracts entered into by the operator in their capacity as operator of the camp, give each adult occupant of the camp a written document published in English and in the language used to communicate with the occupants stating the terms and conditions for occupancy, post a notice in the area of the camp containing the following information: a statement that the licensee is licensed, address and phone number of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, et cetera, on page 4. And then down on line 26, no licensee or person operating a farm worker camp shall make misrepresentations, false statements, or willful concealment in an application, et cetera. There are several other things. Then section 9, no farm worker camp employer operator shall discharge, evict, or in any manner discriminate against any occupant of the farm worker camp. And because the occupant has made a claim against the operator for compensation for the occupant's personal services, or the occupant has caused to be instituted any proceedings under or related to this act, or the occupant has testified or is about to testify in any such proceeding, or the occupant has discussed or consulted with anyone concerning the occupant's rights under the law. So there's a number of things there that we're attempting to ensure are carried out, and we're attempting to make sure that rights are not abused, rights under the law of the tenants. Section 10 provides the commissioner may adopt rules for this section, and Section 11 allows that the commissioner may revoke, suspend, or refuse to renew or issue a license under certain conditions. Section 12 provides that all proceedings shall be relating to the issuance, revocation, suspension, renewal, or refusal to license shall be carried out under the ORS 183, which is Boley's procedure for contested case hearings. Section 13 provides that in addition to any other penalty provided by law, the commissioner in the same manner may file for contested case proceeding under ORS 183, Chapter 183, and may assess a civil penalty. Section 14 provides that let's see, it provides that no person transacting business regulated by sections 2 to 17 of this act is entitled to demand, receive, or accept any fee, directly or indirectly, or maintain any suit or action in the courts involving the business without alleging or proving the person was licensed to transact such business. And that the commissioner also may obtain an order from an appropriate circuit court to enjoin someone against an activity that's forbidden. Section 15 provides that an agreement by a seasonal farm worker purporting to modify their rights under the law is void. Their rights are guaranteed and avoidable. Section 16, all fees or the money received by the commissioner shall be credited to the Bureau and shall be used for the administration of the act. So the fees would not go into the general fund. The commissioner could charge fees for the license. That's also provided for. Section 18 and on relates to APD's registration of camps. So up to 17, we're talking about the commission licensing camp operators. From 18 on, APD is registering camps. Section 20 provides that no person shall establish, maintain, or otherwise operate a farm worker camp without a valid registration certificate. Section 21 provides the terms and conditions for issuing the certificate. Section 22 requires a bond for the person applying for the certificate. And this is a point that the committee will have to consider. It is probably unnecessary to have a bond for the operator and for the registration for the camp. We'd want to just have one bond per camp. So we'd need to go delete one of those requirements for bonding for each camp. Section 23, upon receipt of the application, the director shall cause an inspection of the camp. So APD would inspect the camp when there's an application to be registered. Section 24, the director shall adopt rules, and there's a listing of what the rules will pertain to. Basically, it lists the primary headings of the state health and safety plan. The rules would echo the health and safety plan and implement the health and safety plan. That's the intent. We go further down. I'm going to try to avoid redundancy. There's other proceedings and powers to give the commissioner of or the director of insurance and finance the powers to implement APD's responsibility under the act. They're similar to the ones relating to bullying. Then we get down to 36, and we talk about an eligible daycare center. Is one owned and operated by a nonprofit corporation, and we have an addition of farm worker camp to the current definition. And this is, as I understand it, this is see if I can remember correctly which one we're looking at here. I would have to check the reference on that to be sure. I believe it's relating to the nonprofit daycare statutes. The ones relating particularly to farm labor camps, and we're trying to correct the reference there to plug it into our definition. And Section 37, we're talking about civil penalties that the director may impose for violation of the registration requirements. So we have two different approaches. This bill, frankly, needs some correction in several points. I think the bonding requirement needs to be corrected, and we need to double-check our references to licensure or registration to make sure our references are correct. So we do need to give this one a close scrutiny and make sure there are no technical errors in the bill, but the intent is clear. The camps need to be registered in every case. They need to meet APD standards in every case. The person who operates the camp needs to be known, needs to be qualified, and there needs to be a bond posted for performance related to that camp. It's most logical, probably, for the operator to post that bond. The operator and the person owning the camp may very well be different people, and that's one reason to have both registration. The owner would register the camp. The operator may change from time to time, but we should know who the operator is for that camp, too. With these tools, we feel we can get a much better handle on the problems that we encountered similar last summer, where we had the horrible camps. It was very difficult to identify who was responsible, who was operating the camps. There's no performance bonding requirement, and enforcement of the law was mainly achieved through APD red tagging the structures. as if they were machines in a lumber mill. That's fine as far as it goes, but it sure doesn't go far enough. So we need to improve our ability to control conditions in the camps, and we hope this will do it. Senate Bill 733 is a simpler bill. It relates to farm workers' right of free association. It provides that among the people authorized to enter a farm worker camp, we would include, and this is the new language, representatives of religious organizations, organizations that are exempt from income taxes under 26 U.S.C. Section 501c3, that is federal nonprofit corporations, and any other providers of services for farm workers funded by state, federal, or local government. Because we want these people to be able to enter the camp and deliver their services. These are charitable activities and government activities. And currently, some camp operators have forbidden these people to trespass on their camp territory. So charitable organizations have been forbidden, in some cases, from entering a camp to provide charitable benefits to the tenants of the camp. In some cases, representatives of government agencies have been forbidden from entering the camps. And sometimes the individual can go and get a warrant. It shouldn't be necessary for a charitable organization to be denied.